I have found out beat news in depth for you.
Good evening and welcome to this Outbeat Extra edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, if you've been to a fundraiser for an LGBT organization just about anywhere in this country, you've probably enjoyed Barefoot Wines. They've generously supported our community for many years, and Randy Arnold is the reason. He's here with us tonight to share his story. And in the second half of our hour, we'll talk about this week's news with Jeffrey Masters. He's an actor and host of LGBTQA on AfterBuzz TV. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio news for this Sunday, July 30th, 2017.
I have found Outbeat Radio news, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of July 30th, 2017. LGBTQ Nation reports the British government plans to make it easier for people to change their gender by removing a requirement for a medical diagnosis. Equalities Minister Justine Greening says people seeking to legally change gender will have to prove that they've been in a transition for at least 2 years, but they will not need a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, a requirement seen as intrusive by many trans people. Greening says the Conservative government wants to tackle some of the historic prejudices that still persist in their laws. Susanna Hopwood of the LGBT group Stonewall says the change announced this last week will help fix a demeaning and broken system. Conservative and Christian groups argue the move will make changing gender too easy. The plan still has to go through consultation and legislation stages before becoming law. But here in the United States, in the state of Texas, things aren't progressing so well. Transgender Texans are having their public rights sent back to the Stone Ages after the state Senate Affairs Committee voted to approve Senate Bill 3. This bill, like many other proposed ones of its kind, forces transgender individuals to use public restrooms that correspond with their assigned gender at birth. The bill goes on to prevent public facilities like schools and government offices from enforcing rules that contradict this law. More than 250 LGBTQ business owners, activists, school administrators, and teachers signed up to testify against the bill, quoting the heart-rending suicide rates in the trans community and how a public lashing out like this could increase them. Kelly Cohn, a staff attorney for the ACLU's Texas branch, said the legislation was in violation of the Constitution and added they've introduced legislation that targets transgender Texans under the guise of privacy and safety. That's not what those bills do. What they do, in fact, is push transgender people away from being able to participate in public life. And in Pennsylvania, a lesbian couple said that they were looking for a wedding dress 2 weeks ago, but all they found in the shop was bigotry. Shannon Kennedy and Julianne Samanis visited the WW Bridal Boutique in Bloomberg, Pennsylvania, with Julianne's sister in preparation for their March 2018 wedding. They were given a form to fill out, and that's when the bridal shop owner found out that they were a same-sex couple. Julianne told the Philadelphia Gay News, "We filled out the form that said bride's name, budget, and where it said groom, we crossed it out and put bride. We put Shannon's name down." They handed the form to one of the employees, who then asked them if the dress was for a same-sex wedding. After responding in affirmative, the store employee responded, "I don't know if you've heard, but we're Christian and we don't believe in that. Our faith doesn't believe in that." And here locally, Private Lives, Private Lives, the original play written by our own Dr. Diana Greer, will be performed in Healdsburg at the Raven Theater on Saturday, August 12th at 7 p.m., and then again on Sunday, August 13th at 2 p.m. This production is being sponsored by Santa Rosa PFLAG. If you haven't seen this amazing play, this is your opportunity. You can learn more and get tickets at PrivateLivesPrivateLies.com. And finally, SRJC and Napa Valley College are both offering courses this fall in LGBT studies. An introduction to LGBT studies starts on August 14th at Napa Valley College. You can learn more at napavalley.edu. And the LGBT literature course starts on Monday, August 21st at Santa Rosa JC. You can learn more at santarosa.edu. And the Russian River Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence are hosting a bingo benefiting Sadie Haven's Horse Rescue and Sanctuary. This will take place on August 12th at the Guerneville Veterans Memorial Hall. You can learn more and get tickets at rrsisters.org. For a calendar of LGBT news and events happening here in the North Bay, go to gaysonoma.com. And for all the latest LGBT news headlines we're following, go to our website at outbeatnews.com. For KRCB's Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
Our first guest tonight grew up in Sebastopol. 25 years ago, he became the ambassador for Barefoot Wines and discovered his passion for supporting the LGBT community and its many incredible nonprofit organizations. One of the first of many organizations he supported was the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus. Here to tell us more about his career and about Barefoot Wines is Randy Arnold. Randy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
It's great to have you. And to talk about Barefoot Wines, which has been around for a really long time, predating Stonewall. From what I read, the winery started in 1965. So tell our listeners who aren't familiar with Barefoot and with you a little bit about the story of the winery and then how you got involved.
Yeah, we have a very long history, and very few people are aware that Davis Bynum started the Barefoot brand out in the 1960s here in the Bay Area. Davis Bynum produced Barefoot Bynum from the mid-60s to the mid-70s, and then 10 years went by, and two friends of his, Michael Houlihan and Bonnie Fun, they brought it back, and people recognized it, so that was really fantastic. So Michael and Bonnie started Barefoot out really in 1986, and I went to work for them in 1990, so I was one of their first winery employees, and we started out on a very small scale based on the Russian River region of western Sonoma County.
Wow. So had you been in the wine business before, or was this a new venture for you?
Well, actually, I grew up in Sebastopol in western Sonoma County, and my mother's family have vineyards going back to 1881 in Alexander Valley. They had established a French utopian colony in Alexander Valley in 1881, actually. And then my father's family were from Sebastopol, and I grew up there in Sebastopol. So I have lots of wine background in my family and throughout my history as well.
Wow, sounds like it's in your genes.
Yes, it is, indeed.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I've seen the Barefoot label, you know, at LGBT events for years and years and years. When did the company get involved so closely with the LGBT community, and what was their attraction?
You know, I was hired in 1990, and a friend of Michael's asked him, he said, "Aren't you afraid that Barefoot will be the gay wine?" And Michael said, "I'm more afraid if it's not." And so I knew that they had donated to nonprofits before they hired me. And I thought, you know, let's continue to do this. Let's support the community. And, you know, most nonprofits need wine and bubbly for their fundraising. So it's a great door opener to all sorts of organizations that we feel strongly about. And, you know, the LGBT community is my community. So that was the first place that I started donating Barefoot and working with nonprofits to raise money for the community. So it was a natural place for me to start.
Well, that's terrific. I mean, it's always great to see local businesses support the community in an important way like that. And I think Barefoot was probably one of the first wineries. I mean, there's a number of wineries now that have different campaigns and different efforts towards our civil rights movement. But I think Barefoot was probably the first, yeah?
I think we probably were very early in the process, and I think I was probably one of the first out gay sales managers as well in the business. So, you know, Michael and Bonnie have lots of gay and lesbian friends, so it also made sense for them to be involved because who wouldn't want to help your friends? And that's really the way that we looked at the situation. And it was the 90s, and it was a time that our community really needed a lot of support. And we were able to be there and be supportive through donations of product and then help with fundraising so as well.
That's terrific. And I'm sure you've had a chance to attend a lot of different events and support a lot of different organizations through those events. Talk about some of the ones that stand out to you that you think are most significant or perhaps the ones that you've been involved with the longest.
Yeah, you know, recently for my 25th anniversary, I went through my my files and I started adding up the nonprofits that I donated to, and it came to over 200 in my 27 wow. years with Barefoot. And then I figure I have poured at about 1,200 benefits, which is really a great life to be at 1,200 different benefits, raising money for all sorts of community causes is really a fantastic thing. But I'd say, you know, just to keep it to Western Sonoma County, I was Grand Marshal in the Sonoma Pride Parade during my 25th anniversary year. And I went to check in, and they said, your contingent number is one. And I said, what do you mean by one? And they said, you're leading the parade. And I turned to my husband, and who is quite a character, and I said, I never expected to lead the parade. And he said, you expect me to believe that.
Well, that's terrific. You've been involved with local organizations and organizations at the state and national level. What are some of the larger ones across the country for our listeners who are not from the Sonoma County area?
Yeah, the Barefoot Wine Rule sponsored 200 prides worldwide. So I actually attended five prides in June. So June is a crazy, crazy month for us, traveling around, trying to get to as many different pride events as possible. And my husband and I have also attended a pride in Brighton, England that we sponsored as well. So it's a great opportunity. And actually this year, we're very excited in August. My husband and I, Greg and I, will be attending Canada's first national pride in Montreal. So that's going to be quite a fantastic event. And for when World Pride was held in Toronto, our Canadian team created an 80-foot-long pride banner, and that was carried there. And then it's been at probably 15 different prides throughout the United States, and we're going to be able to return our Canadian pride banner to Canada, and it'll be carried in the Montreal Pride Parade as well. So that's going to be a really exciting moment for us.
Boy, no kidding. I was in Toronto for the World Pride Celebration in 2014, and have to say that was probably one of the best Pride celebrations I've ever been to. Really amazing.
They did an incredible job, and it doubled the size of Toronto Pride. They went from 1 million to 2 million people. Now, coming up in 2 years, World Pride will be in New York City, and we'll be a part of that. So if you can imagine, doubling anything in New York City is going to be a pretty amazing event.
No kidding. Only in the way that New York can do it, right?
Right.
Let's talk about the wines. For people who have not had a chance to taste Barefoot wines, talk about the different varietals and the ones that you think are really standouts.
You know, we like to think that we make something for everybody. So we make 18 different wines, 11 Barefoot bubblies, and then five of our Barefoot Refresh wines. And it's always great to talk about the newest thing, which would be our rosé. So that came out this summer, and rosé is the hottest category in wine. And so that's our biggest release this year. We're always coming out with new things and creating new things from Barefoot. So I'm very excited about the opportunity for a fantastic new rosé. And our top-selling wine is actually Pinot Grigio, and it is the number one-selling Pinot Grigio in the world. So you could say that we've had a lot of success with this varietal, but it's a wonderful wine. It really is has light-bodied notes of pear and lemon, and it's super, super refreshing as well. And the newest category that we've created is called the Barefoot Refresh Spritzers. And it's a new category of wine that is refreshing. And if you think about it, when people are looking for refreshment, they usually leave the wine category. So we've created something for them. It's a wine product that has half the alcohol of wine, 6.5% alcohol, and it has a third of the CO2 of champagne. So that gives it the spritzer effect. And we came out with our spritzers in cans, which has been a huge success last summer. And now we have four different types in barefoot cans. And that's a huge growth area for the wine industry. We like to say that there's a big opportunity for no glass, no problem. And serving wine in aluminum cans is really a great innovation and a great way to go.
Well, I'm just thinking about entertaining our own guests in our pool in our backyard. And, of course, we don't allow glass. And so that does sound like a great option.
Yeah, there's so many opportunities, you know, camping and boating and getting out and being active where glass really isn't a good option for you. So
I've always, you know, as I look back at trends in wine, it's always struck me as very interesting how, you know, wines become popular and then they drift away, and yet they're the same wine and the same flavor. I mean, decades ago, when I was 21, I remember White Zinfandel was the huge rage. And then there was a big Merlot movement. And then you mentioned Rosé as being kind of the big one right now. What do you think creates a trend in wine?
You know, I think popular culture has a lot to do with the trends in you know, all of the alcoholic beverages, and especially wine. You know, recording artists wrote lyrics about Moscato, and suddenly Moscato really hit it big and was enormous, and it's still growing for us. So Moscato is really a fantastic opportunity. So it's popular culture. You know, the crazy movie Sideways that occurred 13 years ago.
Right.
Ever since the movie Sideways, Pinot Noir has been increasing in volume, and Merlot has been down every single month for 13 years. So, and that's just based on one movie. But there has to be a lot more than just popular culture. And what's really important is the quality of the product. And California produces 90% of the wine produced in the United States. And we've learned a lot over the years. If you look back, let's say 15 years ago, California really didn't have a great Pinot Noir. It was the ugly duckling of wine. And there were very few Pinot Noirs produced. And you look at today, and California is producing so many spectacular Pinot Noirs from all of these different regions that are really impacting the market in a wonderful way. And, you know, Pinot Noir is such a unique varietal. It's really, I look at it as unrelated to flavors of other varietals. So, and so many great areas all over the state. You know, I say that in California, every direction is wine country. So it doesn't matter where you go. There's so much, you know, you think of Sonoma and Napa, but pretty much every region, the Lodi region, we buy a lot of grapes from. And it's the number one region for wine production in California. So with 100,000 acres of vineyard, it's equivalent to Napa and Sonoma counties put together.
Sure, yeah. Well, it's, I've always thought it was interesting. People think that all wine in California comes from Napa Valley, and yet they produce the least amount of grapes per acre, I think, than anywhere else in the state. Right? I mean,
Yeah, Sonoma and Napa are very similar viticulturally. You know, I go back generations. My family go back generations in Sonoma. So it was kind of a funny story. I got a job with a wine distributor, and my mother said, you don't have to sell those horrible Napa County wines, do you? And I said, yes, and I'm going to sell French, Italian, and Australian wines. And she said, you're a disgrace. So I didn't mind being a disgrace because I needed a job.
That competition between Napa and Sonoma continues to come up, doesn't it?
I know. It's kind of ridiculous. I say sometimes they only share a border. and actually, when I went to work for the distributor, I was charged with selling some Sonoma County wines in Napa. And I told the buyers that I was going to parachute in, but I decided that my samples might break. So... And if there's a rule in sales is if you can make people laugh, they will probably buy something from you.
Yeah,
so humor is very important.
Yes, I agree. I agree. So you talked about the fact that this is really an international distribution, but where is Barefoot based? Do you have one production facility someplace, or are there several that take care of producing the different wines?
Yeah, Barefoot was purchased by the Gallo family in 2005, and that has led to a lot of our growth. And Barefoot is now the top revenue winery within the Gallo portfolio. And the Gallos came along, and I remember my first day talking with Stephanie Gallo, who oversaw the transition, and she said, you know, if you had unlimited resources, what would you do? And I said, I would donate more wine to nonprofits. And that's exactly what we've done with the support, the tremendous support of the Gallo family for Barefoot. We now have extended Barefoot. We'll support over 2,000 benefits in North America for nonprofits. And many of those, of course, are in the LGBT community as well. So it's tremendous support coming from the Gallo family. And we created this great partnership between our two companies. So the Gallo Winery is in Modesto, in the, we say, the Great Central Valley. And that's where all of our Barefoot wines are bottled, at that facility in Modesto.
Well, that's great. I have a colleague that recently took a tour of that facility, and he was overwhelmed with not only the technology, but just the massive size of it and what it does.
Yeah, the Gallos, you know, are the largest winery in the world. And they have invested a lot of research that really helped to create the California, the success of the California wine industry. When Ernest and Julio started, they really wanted to increase and improve quality, because they knew that if people were consuming more wine, that the winery would get a share of that increase. So the famous statement is, a rising tide lifts all ships. So it's been really a tremendous amount of support coming from an investment from the Gallo family in the industry to make the industry more successful.
Terrific. So where can people go to experience Barefoot here locally? If they were out touring, are there tasting rooms available, or where's the best place to discover the wines?
Yeah, you know, we don't have a tasting room, actually. So these 2,000 benefits that we do every year, that is our tasting room. So we bring the tasting room to you while raising money for a great cause. And, you know, this past year we sponsored the Sonoma County Hot Air Balloon Festival in Windsor. And we had a mimosa tent, and that was very, very successful for the nonprofit. So, you know, I looked at actually the events that I work with in the North Bay, and the attendance on just the events that I do myself is about 45,000 people. So another great nonprofit is the Mountain Play. They perform on an amphitheater built to the top of Mount Sam. This next year will be their 105th season, and we donate all the wine and bubbly for the event. And we're able to raise a great deal of money for them. So there's lots and lots of great events that we get involved with. And you can also check on our website, and we have events listed that we're supporting on our website as well.
Great. And what is that website?
It's barefootwine.com. Very easy.
Pretty easy to remember. And if you don't remember that, we'll have a link on our own website at outbeatnews.com. You can go there to check out the latest on those spritzers and all the other great varietals that Barefoot is producing.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Greg.
Well, Randy Arnold, congratulations on your 25th anniversary with the company. That's an accomplishment in and of itself, but it sounds like you're having a great time, and more importantly, you're doing some amazing things for our community, and we thank you for that.
All right. Thank you, Greg.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to an Outbeat Extra edition of Outbeat News in Depth on KRCB FM Radio 91. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, my next guest is an actor, writer, and radio program host of LGBTQA, a program that documents the stories of the LGBT community, produced out of Los Angeles. His program has been recommended by the New York Times, USA Today, GLAAD, and BuzzFeed. Jeffrey Masters is here with us tonight to share his story and talk more about news of the week. Well, Jeffrey, welcome to Outbeat Radio. And before we get to talking about all your professional work, for our listeners who are not familiar with you, tell us a bit about yourself, where you grew up, and how you got into the entertainment and news business.
Yeah, definitely. Well, my name's Jeffrey. I grew up in North Carolina, the bathroom state.
The bathroom state.
Just kidding.
Yeah.
It has a bad rap in the news, and the executives are very conservative. But on the whole, North Carolinians are very lovely people. I feel like I need to say that. But besides North Carolina, I live in Los Angeles now, and I have an awesome podcast where I interview different LGBTQ people.
Well, it's really a great show, too. Talk about your acting career. I mean, you've also done some work in various venues in Hollywood. Talk about that.
Yeah. I've done, you know, a bunch of, like, indie feature films that nobody's ever going to see. And, you know, everyone does web right now in L.A. I mean, not L.A., but the world. That's where it's going. So a lot of small acting gigs for that. But like so many, came to L.A. originally to be an actor. And I'm still doing that. But along the way, I found hosting and reporting. And I've always loved journalism. And so I've been steered into that way. And it's a kind of amazing, the industry nowadays, because you can do everything. You don't need to pick just one thing.
Yeah, yeah. And you're a writer, too. You've written for a number of news sources. Tell us about some of the things that you've written and where your passion comes from.
Yeah, I write a lot about gender and sexuality. It's one of those things where I have always gravitated towards that and reading that, and I didn't realize, not to sound cocky, but what an expert I was, let's say, in gender. And I've, like, read all the scholars, and, you know, maybe I'll eventually be one of those. But I didn't realize until I start working more with LGBTQ organizations what a focus my own reading has been in. So I go in that direction. And so I love to also just write personal essays around, you know, queer life.
So are they mostly reflections of your own life, or are they fiction, or what type of writing?
It's half and half. It's half about news stories going on right now in the community, and half about, like, my own life and a lot of dating stories. You know, I'm still young and that kind of stuff.
That could be fun.
Yeah, it is. It's always funny to think, like, this person's not going to read this, right? And I have to be more selective on what I promote and what I tell people I have written versus am writing.
Okay. And so what are some of the pieces that have been published that stand out to you? You know, some of the ones you're most proud of?
I'm most proud of a couple of pieces I've done at Pop Sugar. Do you know that website?
I don't.
It's an entertainment. It's hard to describe. It's a website, and they make content geared towards women, but they're a massive lifestyle brand. So it's entertainment news. It's like celebrity gossip, although they would hate the word gossip. It's and lifestyle company, so fitness, this and that. And I'm really happy to have written a couple articles for them about like the transgender like bathroom bills that are happening around the country. One specifically tied to Gavin Graham and the Supreme Court case around that. Just I'm really happy to write for such a non-queer outlet to make, because they're focusing on these issues and they're not ignoring them, which I really appreciate.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I mean, it's one thing to write for our own audience, and certainly, as my friends like to say, the choir always needs to practice.
Yeah.
But informing the straight community that isn't aware of anything that's going on with our issues is a real opportunity.
Yeah, it is.
So what feedback have you gotten?
The feedback is mainly positive. And to be completely honest, it's interesting crafting articles for non-queer outlets, because I feel like I'm going back to gender 101. So I would love to, you know, write something for the community and impress everybody with, like, how smart I am and the knowledge. But unfortunately, in America today, people are still at the 101 level in terms of gender and still sexuality. You know, I keep returning to the stat from GLAAD, which is that only 11% of the population knows a trans person or knows that they know a trans person. So that means that 89% of the population doesn't know a trans person. And so a lot of these things are still very new to them.
Right. Well, I think your point's well taken. The bulk of this country still hasn't passed sexual orientation 101, let alone gender 101. It's still so very new.
And for, you know, the non-binary members of our community, the fight has not yet begun.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. The good news is that folks of non-traditional gender identities are beginning to make themselves more visible. And just like gay people made themselves more visible in the 60s and the 70s and 80s, and of course 90s, the world began to change. And so hopefully the same thing will follow suit as more people get to know a person who doesn't identify as cisgender and will learn.
Yeah, and I it's beginning to go that way. And I'm trying to, in my own like activities, make it go a little bit faster if possible.
Good. Well, good for you. I mean, it's kind of all hands on deck right now to get the word out. And you're doing a lot of that with your own weekly podcast show. You're interviewing some pretty interesting folks. Talk about where the idea came to do that and what your mission is with the program.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. So it started because I love interview shows like Fresh Air and Mark Maron's podcast, and I really wanted to, and I love listening to them, and I wanted one for LGBTQ people, and no one was doing it. And it kind of baffled me, and I realized that I've been studying long-form interviews, interviewing mainly authors for a while, for a couple websites, and I just figured, like, the time was now, and it's such a no-brainer idea that why shouldn't I be the one to do it?
Right,
to
right.
be honest.
No, you're right.
I also, thank you. Yeah, I also knew that, like, I get frustrated by other outlets when they do cover LGBTQ people. I want them to cover us as much as possible, but again, they have to kind of go to the basics. And so, and that when we go to basics, we tend to focus on coming out stories and transition stories, and it's a big part of our experience, but it ignores our accomplishments.
Right.
And it's not like the bulk of what we're here to discuss. And I still hear great, amazing interviewers that I look up to and that I'm half interviewer, but they still focus on what hormones are you on and like naming medications. And that just isn't a big part of our story. And for so many people, or at least like the older members of the trans community, it's in the past. That's something that, yes, it happened. Absolutely. But they've done so much since then, and they're changing so many lives. So I wanted to create a program that didn't just focus on coming out stories. And I also wanted to create something that focused on the entire community.
That's great.
You know, thank you. Yeah, I can get frustrated with a lot of outlets where it tends to focus a little bit more on like white gay men, to be honest. I think it's really embarrassing to say that this is an LGBTQ outlet, and then 90% of the content is about gay people, mm-hmm. and 90% of them are white.
And that's a big issue in our community. It has been, as long as I've been aware of it, we still subsegregate ourselves in ways that are not helpful.
And it's unfortunate. And some people think that it's a myth that we are a community because we are so diverse, and anyone can be, you know, queer or trans. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not just like, I don't know, like a certain area of the world. And so I'm really trying to highlight how diverse we are. We've had queer Muslims on. We've had trans people from all ages. We've had gay men from my generation and from, you know, Harvey Milk's generation, and people from across every profession. And I'm really proud of that.
That's really cool. Who are some of the people that really stand out to you? I mean, I know I've interviewed some folks that, you know, I will always remember the time that I got to sit with them. Have you had any of those moments yet?
Yeah. The first person that comes to mind is Jennifer Finney Boylan. She is a trans writer and activist, and she is a college professor from New England. And she is really responsible, I believe, for introducing America to what transgender people are and what they look like beyond just sex workers. Because for so long, you know, a trans person was on TV and they were on Jerry Springer and they were a sex worker. And that is a real honest part of our culture, but it's not the only part, you know? Mm-hmm. And so here Jennifer Finney Boylan is. She wrote a memoir. This was like 15 years ago. And she was on Oprah talking about it. And America got to see this just nice, smart professor who happened to be trans. And I really think that she helped change a lot of public perception. And so to be able to meet somebody like that, whose work I followed for so many years, was just really an incredible thing.
Yeah, that is really fun when you get a chance to read ahead of time before you talk to the person and get to know them. They almost seem like a long-lost friend returned. When you admire their work, I mean, it even makes it more meaningful.
Yeah, I agree completely. And then also, I think it's really memorable when somebody can change your mind. You know, I interviewed Perez Hilton, who has a really strong mm-hmm. reputation in Hollywood. I think he has a strong reputation everywhere, right?
Yep. And not necessarily a good one.
Yeah, not at all. And he's somebody who changed and apologized 5 years ago, and nobody seems to care about the apology. They still have a bad reputation about him. And for him, I was really impressed at the kind of the businessman that he is. He built this media empire, you know, and whether or not you like his website or not, it still is one of the most popular ones in the world. And that is really impressive. And so I think people like that are interesting.
Yeah, I can see that. So we're talking to all of our listeners this year, like yourself, about their experience with the election. And So let's go back to November. Did you think that there was any possibility that Donald Trump would be our president?
Yes. And that is because I volunteer at the Trevor Project. And so I speak to people from all around the country. And it's kind of has clued me into just what our country looks like, to be completely honest.
Tell me more about that. I mean, what have you heard through the voices of the people you've talked to?
I hear fear and I hear misunderstanding. And I think that if you give people the opportunity to get to know a queer person, hopefully they will change. But that change takes time. Mm-hmm. And that acceptance, it takes time. And I think that we're still in this waiting period for full acceptance for LGBTQ people, clearly. And so I feel like I got a sample size over the entire country of people struggling. And so, no, I didn't want to believe that he could win, but it was not a black and white surprise.
Hmm. Yeah, maybe we're just all in denial up here. I think, you know, clearly he had a lot of visibility, but I was a little surprised. I thought, God, this country has got to have more sense than that.
Yeah. I mean, no, I agree. I think that we, also being from North Carolina, you know, I visited there and I saw a sea of red Make America Great Again hats.
Yeah.
And so it just kind of like also confirmed my confirmation bias from living in a very gay part of Los Angeles.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so, you know, we talked to folks who, after the election, felt this real need to find community, to find other people like them. I mean, one of the things that's obviously happened in the last 15, 20 years is, you know, this migration out of the gayborhoods into mainstream America. And so a lot of folks I talked to wanted to run back to those neighborhoods to be with community. For you as an individual in LA, what was it like the day after the election? Did you feel a panic at all?
I deal with trauma differently, to be honest, and I am an optimist. And so I knew that things were going to most likely get bad, but for the day after the election, it was yet to get bad. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I was like delaying my rage and my hurt at what our country actually looks like, because all of the things I was worried about, I still had 2.5 months to figure out. You know, be it like the repealing of the protections for transgender youth, or be it the lack of access for AIDS medication. These are all things that are you can and need to be concerned about. But, you know, November 8th, they hadn't yet happened. So I was still in disbelief.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And so you mentioned a couple of the things that were apparent threats. They were talked about quite a bit in the news leading up to the election, and people pondering about what might happen. You know, as you look out now to the future, based upon what you've seen so far, you know, what are you seeing of the threats to our community?
Well, I was really concerned a couple of weeks ago with the headlines coming up from the White House saying, I think the top 7 people working in AIDS and HIV advocacy like stepped down because they said this administration just does not care. Mm-hmm. And the lack of people working, but they just hadn't hired, you know, these leadership roles. But from a larger perspective, I'm most concerned that the president doesn't seem to have values of any kind. And that is a person that you cannot reason with, right?
Right.
If he was anti, like Mike Pence is completely terrifying to me, but he has values and you can work with somebody like that because he's very Christian and he's very anti-gay and he wants certain things.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of folks think that Pence is a much more serious threat, and I see him being about as bad as George Bush, and frankly, I would take him in a heartbeat over what we have now.
I'm beginning to be on that train as well. Pence is scary, but the things that he can do will also be like out in the public. So, I just think that it's somebody that you're able to reason with because he has values.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I cannot confirm this story, but I'd love to tell you it anyways.
Go for it.
And that is where somebody that I know, this is completely 100% hearsay, so please know that. Somebody that I know is friends with Mike Pence's daughter and said that she is studying abroad right now in some small, like, town in, like a very small city in Africa or, like, Eastern Europe, and that she's extended her study abroad, and she wants to be there for 4 years because she does not approve of what this government is doing, and she doesn't want to be associated with her father at all, and she's so completely embarrassed that she doesn't want to return to this country. Well, and I just love that, to be honest.
I love it, too, and it wouldn't necessarily surprise me. I mean, part of what's going on here, I think, is very generational. I would find it hard to believe that the bulk of people his daughter's age would approve of what they're seeing going on. It's kind of crazy to take a look at it. We posted some statistics about the number of people who didn't vote, and actually the graphic read, the real president of the United States is the person who didn't vote. 29.9% of the people who were eligible to vote simply didn't do it. So that left 19%, 19.8% of the vote for Hillary and 19.5% for Trump. So, you know, a pretty small margin separating those, but a very large margin of people who simply didn't participate. And I'm curious, I have to wonder if those people did vote, how it would have turned out. I don't think we would be where we are right now.
I agree. I can't even begin to fathom reasons not to vote, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, was that exciting for you when you turned voting age and got a chance to go out and do that?
Oh my God. Absolutely. I voted in every election.
Yeah.
I also feel like I complain a lot about what's going on, and I'm able to do that because I vote, because I volunteer in the community, because I'm hopefully creating stuff and writing articles to change opinion.
Yeah. Well, as an activist, then you have that sort of built-in motivation to want to be part of the system, and you certainly can't be critical of it or those who don't participate unless you're out there voting yourself. Why do you think so many people aren't voting? What's lacking in the participation or the interest in participating?
Wow, I have no idea. That's a massive number. I cannot begin to guess, because I am filled with such a rage reading the headlines, and I don't know why other people wouldn't be.
Well, you know, Australia, I think, has it right, because if you don't vote, then you get fined in that country.
That sounds great.
So, you know, anybody who is eligible to vote must vote by law. And I think, you know, that's what should happen here. You know, maybe if you vote, you get a tax credit. And if you don't vote, then you get an additional bill on your taxes or something like that. I mean, I'm not suggesting that we criminalize not voting, but I do think that we need to find a way to get people off their duffs to vote, because we ended up with a disaster this time, really, because people didn't. Okay, that's our soapbox conversation for the night, right?
Absolutely.
Well, you follow the news a lot, obviously. What are some of the stories this week that stood out to you?
Well, I was made the joke earlier that I am from North Carolina, the bathroom state, and there I'm really intrigued by this current bathroom bill that, you know, they're trying to pass in Texas.
Yeah,
it's doing the same thing. It's forcing transgender people to use bathrooms that are correspond to their assigned gender from birth, and it's a way to keep trans people out of public spaces and to increase violence.
Yeah, we're pretty concerned about the genitalia of the person who's sitting in the stall next to us as a society, aren't we?
Yeah, we are.
Kind of,
and that is a created fear from the other side, you know?
Yeah, most definitely. Their story this morning was talking about how many hours of testimony they heard in Texas, and people still were not convinced. So it kind of goes to that point about education, right? You were talking about how we need to educate people around gender and gender identity, and yet it's like the legislature there isn't even listening to that.
I also was really disturbed by one of the Republican senators' comments. It was Senator Craig Estes, because the opposition was bringing up suicide rates of trans people and how public lashing out like this could increase them. I think that right now the stat is about 40% of trans people have or will try to take their own life, which is a massive number.
Yep.
And the Republican senator responded with, "I'm hearing that it's somehow our fault that people are committing suicide. Another explanation could be that people are depressed." And, you know, it's just like trans people are not more, you know, medically and chemically inclined to try to take their own lives. It is the system that they're in, and it's like the world that we are creating for them.
Right.
Which made my blood boil.
Yeah, no. And this is not just an isolated incident in North Carolina or Texas. There are a number of bills around the country. The conversation seems to be coming from everywhere you look, except for those of us in the bubble here in California.
And also with this current Texas bill, they it would prevent any public facility like a school or government office from enforcing rules that would contradict the law.
Right. It's another example of a state trying to circumvent a local jurisdiction's desire to create some inclusivity.
Yeah.
Like what happened in North Carolina with the city of Charlotte.
Yeah, it's really just unfortunate that that is, like you said, like where all the public energy is going. With the hours of testimony, we could be doing 1,000 other things.
Yes, we could.
Also, transgender people have used the bathroom and public bathrooms for years, and you're now just caring.
Right, right. Well, because, you know, people haven't paid attention. But there's a hysteria that's coming along with this that becomes very popular to talk about. And it all goes back to that age-old, archaic argument about we've got to protect the children. Same argument that was used in the marriage debate.
And with children, it's always, this is a created fear. You know, it's never kids at school saying, oh my God, you know, this person's in the bathroom with me. It's 100% of the time, it is the parent finding out that there's a trans kid and then creating the issue.
Right. Exactly. And then there's the very stupid argument about, well, this is just going to allow people to go in and take advantage of a situation where they can go in and assault my daughter. A man can go into a bathroom. Into a girl's bathroom anytime they want, and
that's already
daughter.
Illegal.
That is already illegal, right? Exactly, and it's illegal in California. I mean, we have, I think, very strong inclusive access to restrooms for people based on how they identify their gender, but we also have strong laws that are in place that prohibit perverts from going in and doing exactly what these folks are suggesting. So.
Yeah,
that exists
in
every
California,
state.
We have some of the most trans-inclusive laws in the country, and it's still not safe enough. And then last thing about the point about the suicide rates, the month of the election in November after Trump was elected, since I worked at the Trevor Project, the Trevor Project had their highest call volume on record ever in November.
I bet.
And since then, it has only increased. So I don't think the numbers are out for June yet, but May was the highest call volume on record, and every month this year has increased.
Wow. And are these primarily calls from trans kids, or is it across the spectrum?
It's the entire LGBTQ spectrum.
So everyone within the spectrum is concerned. That's sad. Is there any kind of regionalization? Are they coming from a particular part of the country, or is it pretty much all over?
I don't have those stats on me. I don't know that those are public stats, but they accept calls from all over.
Yeah, yeah. No, I was just curious. I think it would be interesting. And it would be important for Trevor to put that out there. I don't think they would compromise anybody's confidentiality by coming out with some broad numbers like that.
Yeah, I don't know. And I will say, too, that the Trevor Project is, if people don't know what it is, it's in a suicide and crisis intervention helpline. They also have texting. They also have instant messaging. And it's the only nationally accredited one for LGBTQ people.
Yeah, they do they do a fantastic job. We've talked about them on the show here before. And
fantastic.
I think they're one of my favorites in terms of supporting youth, for sure.
Yeah.
You know, another story that's been dominating the headlines here, along with the religious liberty bill debate, are a couple of cases winding their way up to the Supreme Court around bakers and florists that have been fined for not providing services to same-sex couples who want to get married. The latest story coming out today was from a dress shop who said that they could not provide a bridal dress to a lesbian couple because of their Christian beliefs.
Wow, another one, huh?
Another one. So, you know, when are people going to get over this? Or do you think this is an orchestrated effort to test the marriage case?
It is orchestrated, and I think that we are still in the beginning phases of it. You know, I think that religious liberty is the next, like, from the other side, it's their next big fight because they're making it about them, and they're not making it about being anti-LGBTQ.
So I read last week that the president told a group of conservative religious leaders during a National Prayer Day event that guidance on religious liberty was coming out. It was forthcoming.
They've been saying that for a while.
Yep.
Yes.
They have, and I've yet to see anything about that. It's going to be pretty interesting. I think one of the last statistics that I saw was that there were over 100 bills at the state level that attempted to define or carve out some definition or right to religious liberty. And those are certainly being debated in state houses. But I agree with you. I think these cases that are winding their way out through the courts of appeal around refusing to make a wedding cake and refusing to provide flowers and now this wedding dress, there is some organization to it that is designed to challenge the marriage decision. And perhaps they're just waiting until Anthony Kennedy or Ruth Bader Ginsburg retire so we can get another conservative justice appointed.
I felt an earthquake when you said retirement for the Supreme Court justices.
Yeah.
I feel like we need like create like a charity where we like bubble wrap like the two of them and like walk them around and one person can like donate it every day. It's with the religious liberty. I don't even know what to say. It's just so silly, you know?
So as you look at it, I mean, you've watched the system for a while now. You're actively involved in everything that's going on. As you look at it, what do you think is possible? I mean, do you see, as you look up, one of those justices being replaced? Do you think that the court would overturn it?
At this current time, no, they would not. But I don't know. I want to believe it's not possible because public opinion has moved so much in our favor in terms of the right to get married. I'm less concerned with like the right to get married and more concerned with the fact that, you know, trans women of color are being killed and no one is taking the blame, or, you know, that we continue to ignore that.
Right. Well, I just think that the marriage case is symbolic of,
yeah,
of so many.
And it's so hugely important. It gives so many queer couples, you know, health insurance to fight for things. And especially coming out of like the AIDS epidemic, it was so massive and symbolic, but I don't think that it's going away personally. Do you?
You know, I didn't think Trump was going to get elected either. And I think I got a little too cocky about my thinking about the reasonableness of this country and the reasonableness of voters. And, you know, the vote at the Supreme Court was narrow. Now, granted, I agree, they haven't overturned decisions like that in a way that would result in the taking away of an opportunity or a right in any time I could think of. The opportunities where they have overturned a decision have typically provided more liberty than have taken away. So
yes,
I would like to hold on to that as some sense of insurance that no, they wouldn't take that right away. But so many crazy things have happened now. I don't know. I think there's sort of a whiplash effect that's going on here after marriage and 8 years of gains of rights, where the religious conservatives are really pushing hard. And there is a much older generation of people making decisions for us that don't necessarily reflect the majority of younger people in this country, I believe. So what else do you have in your news file?
I wanted to talk about something happy, if that's okay.
Oh, please. I didn't mean for this to be such a downer.
No, I'm totally joking. I wanted to talk about, it was Comic-Con last weekend, and there's all the superhero panels, and I just think it is so exciting that Ezra Miller is playing the Flash in the new Justice League movies.
Okay, so this is way out of my league. I know what Comic-Con is a bit, but I have not watched a lot of the superhero film. So fill us in.
Okay, so this is the DC Universe, which has Wonder Woman and Batman and the Flash. And the actor playing the Flash is an openly queer man.
Really?
Yes, and so he's going to be in the new Justice League movie with Wonder Woman and Superman, all these big people like Aquaman, and then he's getting his own standalone movie as well. Yeah, and I just think it's so exciting.
It is exciting, and finally, right, for young people, young gay people, to be able to maybe see someone like themselves represented in something fun like a comic and a movie based on a comic. But there are some gay characters in comics now, yeah?
Yes, there are, and we've seen more of them in the TV shows compared to the movies. I think that almost every TV show in the DC slate, like The Flash and like Supergirl, has a gay character. But movie-wise, it's been light and never an out gay actor before.
Okay, so this is pretty significant. And the fact that the characters have become visible in sort of these modern-day versions, they're not the villains either. They're the good guys who happen to be gay or lesbian, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And that is, that's important.
Yeah, I just think it goes it complicates the narratives around queer people. You know, we are always the best friend. We're always, you know, like the young assistant or like the person helping a female pick out a dress. So to see us in this different representation, it's just really exciting.
Very good. So you went to Comic-Con?
I went last year. I skipped this year because I've been tired and I wanted to sleep. And it's an exhausting experience.
So for someone who's never been, what is that experience like?
So it's like 4 days in San Diego. It's the biggest in the country. It's got to be 500,000 people. It's completely massive. And it's 500,000 people in like their favorite place on Earth. So these are people who have grown up with comic books, who watch the movies, and they come and everyone dresses up every day. And from a press side of it, which is how I went last year, you get to interview the casts and crews of some of the biggest movies ever, you know, and there's massive panels to introduce things. And it's just walking in massive crowds every day. And it's so exciting, though, to see the different people dress up as characters, because nobody dresses up to because people don't care. How can I phrase this? It's every kind of person is there, and every kind of body type and sexuality and gender, and they don't care which character they're dressed up as. So I think it's really exciting to see, you know, like men dressed as Wonder Woman and women dressed as the Hulk and a 300-pound woman dressed as Wonder Woman also.
Very cool. You know,
there's just every body type there, and people are so happy, and I love seeing that.
Very, very cool. It sounds like a good time. Sounds like a Disneyland type experience.
Exactly.
Where you can really let yourself go and be whoever you want to be. Fun. So before we sign off, tell us where our listeners can go to hear your podcast and follow your work.
Yeah, the easiest place is just on iTunes. The podcast is called LGBT Q&A. I know that sounds like a mouthful, so to be clever, Q&A, yep. Question and answer, but it's called LGBT Q&A. It's on iTunes and YouTube, and they can describe wherever they get a podcast.
Awesome. And we will put links on our own website at outbeatnews.com. You can go there and subscribe. That's really the easiest way. And then it's automatically downloaded into your device. And when you go out for your walk or your run or whatever you do when you listen to your device, you can hear Jeffrey's show.
Yeah, thank you.
Outstanding. Jeffrey Masters, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Fun. We'll need to do this again and talk about more news of the day.
Thank you. I love what you're doing. So it's really cool to be a part of.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of our hour. My thanks to Randy Arnold and Jeffrey Masters for spending time with us tonight. Be sure to tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Radio's Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Greer. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB FM Radio 91. In the meantime, have a great week, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia exclusively for KRCB Radio. Podcasts of our shows are available for on-demand play from iTunes, Google Music, and TuneIn. Get links and sign up for email notifications when new shows become available on our website at outbeatnews.com. And be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter for updates from Outbeat Radio News all week long. Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from members and from Sonoma Go Local. According to a 2013 Federal Reserve study, when communities support smaller, locally owned businesses, the local economy improves. When you shop local, the county experiences increased income, job growth, and less poverty. Sonoma County Go Local helps businesses grow and prosper. Go Local. For more information, visit sonomacounty.golocal.coop. You're listening to Radio 91, 91.1 KRCB FM Windsor, and 90.9 K215 CQ Santa Rosa. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Open Space District is next.